we're here in Ottawa, and we are going to talk to you guys today about Hyper-V Zero to Hero in under an hour, right? So we're going to start off from the very basics, and we're going to get pretty technical for those folks that might not necessarily be too familiar with what Hyper-V is or how it's different from other hypervisors out there. My name is Clint Wyckoff, and this is...
I'm Dave Kawula.
And as always, please interact on the Twitter sphere for the chance to win the free pass to Tech Mentor in December. That's down in Orlando.
This is like our 900th session today, so we're twisting up a few words. That's okay.
Yeah.
Tech Mentor, Orlando, December, worth $2,000.
Free. So be interactive, be social, and get after it. So without further ado, a little bit about me. I kind of gave you guys the history of who I am and what I'm about. So like I said, I'm from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I've been with Veeam Software now for about 3 years. I'm a global technical evangelist for them. And Dave, tell the audience a little about yourself too.
I am a Microsoft Hyper-V MVP. I am a Veeam Vanguard, which is a Veeam MVP,
right?
And work for a few other startups in Silicon Valley doing nothing but Hyper-V. So it's kind of a natural fit for us to be presenting together.
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
So a brief agenda, we're going to start off with Hyper-V 101 and give you guys a brief introduction, as well as talk about storage and network design considerations, because those are probably two of the most important pieces of the virtualized environment, as well as showing you how the Microsoft ecosystem fits together with things and third-party vendors like Veeam. Talk about management, monitoring, reporting, and then leave some time at the end for questions and answers, some Q&A. So, Microsoft Hyper-V availability. How does Microsoft address the concerns and ensure that the hosts are highly available inside the data center today? The first way that they do this is through a technology that you're probably all well familiar with, and that being Windows failover clustering. So if you're used to, or by quick show of hands, how many folks in the audience run Hyper-V today in their environment? Couple? Okay. How many folks are used to maybe some of the vSphere VMware type things? A couple of you guys too? So what I'll do is make reference to both, right? Because at the end of the day, a lot of the technologies are exactly the same behind the scenes, but they call them completely different.
No, you're supposed to keep talking when you do that.
But they call them something different, right? So being able to relate the two together, I personally feel that if you're not necessarily too familiar with it, right, it helps out, right? So a Windows failover cluster within the VMware ecosystem would be equivalent to just a vSphere cluster, right? It's a collection of hosts, right? It could be ESX hosts in the VMware world. And in the Hyper-V world, that's a collection of Hyper-V hosts. And what that allows you to do is being able to ensure HA, right? So if a node goes down, it's going to automatically evacuate all of the virtual machines that are running on there over to the other hosts within the environment, right?
And one of the really interesting things that I found in talking to customers almost every single day about Hyper-V is not every one of them is a Hyper-V existing customer. A lot of them are existing VMware shops. They're interested in the new features and functionality. And when it comes time to actually deploy Hyper-V in a VMware environment, starting to do migrations and transition the skill set, that's actually a really big concern that a lot of VMware administrators have, is that, okay, well, the UI that I have in VMware looks like this, and your Hyper-V stuff looks totally different. I find that with the right tool sets and the right education behind this,
right,
you can transition that skill set in about 2 to 2.5 days. So everything that you know and love about VMware, the constructs that make a virtualization administrator are really universal. So now I just have to port that knowledge over to a Microsoft stack for those VMware admins.
Right.
So that transition time isn't actually that bad. And we do it a lot with customers in the field almost every single day.
Right, and this isn't, the discussion isn't meant to sway you one way or another, right? This is just more of an educational piece of knowing what's out there. Last year, Microsoft actually used to run boot camps, right? They used to call it Hyper-V for the VMware admin, where they would, for free, you could go to like an MTC or a Microsoft Technology Center, and they would have certified trainers come in and kind of debrief people on what the how it relates one to the other.
I think there's some of those sessions that they recorded on the Microsoft Virtual Academy as well. So it's free training on the Microsoft Virtual Academy.
Right.
You just look for Hyper-V for the VMware admin, and they have all of this in kind of like a full-length course, and it's completely free for you guys.
So as you kind of look to migrate workloads, so virtualized applications around the environment from one node to another, whether that be for maintenance windows, security patching, whatever, right? That's done via live migration or storage migration in the Hyper-V area. And you can see here in the diagram on the right-hand side at the top, I've got my main cluster namespace, right? And underneath there, I've got a bunch of different Hyper-V nodes that ultimately have access to my shared storage array underneath. And that can be presented either over SMB or SMB3, which is like network connectivity. Traditionally, like basically it's the equivalent of NFS. Or it can be a LUN or an iSCSI target or a volume, and that would be like a clustered shared volume. And we'll be diving into that here. But as you go through and you build your cluster, anyone in the room ever built a Microsoft cluster, even if it wasn't for Hyper-V, right? It could be a SQL cluster.
Exchange,
right? You go through, and at the end of completing the actual creation of the cluster, you get this fun little output, the cluster validation, right? That it goes through and it makes sure that everything's up to kosher, all the networking IP addresses are good, DNS resolution, everything's good. But have you ever tried to call Microsoft Premier to actually get support? I'm having a problem. I want you to help me fix this. The first thing that they're going to ask you for is, what's the output of your cluster validation, okay? And that's actually saved, and you can see here the results are saved in the C window cluster report directory by default. So if you go through and run that report multiple times, if you add additional nodes into your cluster, that's updated automatically behind the scenes. So you always got the latest copy there for reference.
And I do a lot of work with performance, stress testing related issues and stuff like that around existing Hyper-V and clustering builds. So in a lot of cases, I really don't know what I'm stepping into from a customer environment. They'll tell me one thing, I'll look at an architecture document that may or may not be up to date. I can go grab the latest cluster validation report and I can see the nodes that are joined, I can see the patch levels, I can see everything that happened when those nodes actually joined the cluster. And when you click on the view report inside of the failover cluster manager on the validation tests, it actually brings you to a location in your user profile that you're logged in at in the temp folder. So you think that it's not actually saved, but those are saved, and they're saved in that C drive cluster reports folder. So that's a really good little nugget.
So the way that Microsoft addresses the concerns as it relates to scalability, right? A lot of the VMware folks out there are used to hearing about the vSphere configuration maximums, right? So if you go and take like a VMware test, right? Microsoft has fully documented what they've stress test and load tested in their environments. And you know, a failover cluster, right? I can have 64 nodes, be it Hyper-V nodes, be a part of a cluster. I can have standalone Hyper-V individual virtual machines that have up to 64 virtual CPUs and 4 terabytes worth of virtual RAM. So it's a highly scalable, well thought out, well built solution that they've really evolved over the course of, you know, the different iterations, starting with virtual PC all the way up to Server 2012. 2012 R2, and then moving to 2016 that's going to be coming GA later this year.
So one of the interesting pieces here, Clint, is the number of cluster nodes, 64 nodes in a Hyper-V cluster. We don't see a lot of those in production today, and the reason is the maximum density limitation of 1,000 virtual machines. So I do a lot of work with VDI, and so what we're finding is super compute all-flash arrays are typically getting between 100 to 150 VDI instances, that's VMs per node. So there's no way we're gonna scale that high. So our scalability that we have is we're typically seeing, you know, 8, 10, 12 node clusters, and we're maxing out the actual number of VDI instances. It's not a big deal, because we'll just build another cluster as a sidecar.
Question, sir?
Yeah, just one more, if that's okay. Just with, in relation to storage for Hyper-V, does it prefer SMB versus iSCSI, or is it pretty much performance identical? Just because I know from like, you know, ESX side as of late, it seems to be preferring SMB over
NFS. Right. A lot of the modern storage arrays, at least on the vSphere side, right? A lot of the modern arrays are coming out with NFS support.
Well, yeah.
Why? Is because NFS is obviously it's a file system based, and that allows the storage vendor to actually manage individual VMs and give you visibility at a per virtual machine level instead of at an entire LUN or a volume level. But from a performance perspective, does Hyper-V or even VMware recommend one storage array over another? Ultimately, it depends on the storage array itself. How many IOPS, how much latency, you know, is there SSD in it, or am I running it against, you know, maybe a lesser performance tier?
The architecture and design traditionally that you'll see from Microsoft and MCS is based on a scale-up file server architecture, either using storage spaces direct, depending, all depends on what type of vendor you have, but let's look at a storage spaces. That's typically going to be tiered into a scale-up file server, and so those VMs are going to be presented over SMB. Are they going to perform? Yeah, they're going to perform really well. Now, it all depends on what the storage vendor is that you have. For example, I do a lot of work with GridStore, who's one of the sponsors at the show here. And so they have their own virtual controller. They don't use iSCSI. They don't use SMB. They wrote their own protocol that just sits above the bare metal hypervisor. So the short answer is it depends. But if you're looking for the stock Microsoft answer, is typically you're looking at storage spaces and scale-up file servers, right?
Yeah.
I'm
just curious.
Yep.
Yeah, and one of the things that they're actually introducing in Hyper-V 2016 is the ability to do storage quality of service at a per virtual machine or even a per group of virtual machine together, so you can, you know, limit VMs
policy based. Yep.
Yeah, so you can create policies and say, you know, this group of VMs is my platinum and they get unlimited IO, whereas this group of virtual machines is less required. So if any of the VMs spike, right, I'm going to steal performance away from these guys because maybe they're test or dev.
And we're finding that storage side of the house, being choked out from your I/O is not as much of a concern anymore because you're starting to get flash introduced, you're starting to get accelerators introduced. You're not throttled at like 3,000 I/O trying to stuff everything in there.
Yeah.
Now it's very common to have 100,000 I/O, 200,000. Like you can get large scale arrays.
I deal a lot with SMBs, like really small businesses that want, you know, three or four or five servers, but it doesn't make sense for them. Physical servers. So
yeah, right.
You know, I start going towards, you know, and looking at Hyper-V more, but only because it's now, you know, at least come up to par with ESX for a lot of.
So from that perspective, I have a lot of managed service clients that are like that, small, two or three nodes. They don't have a lot of that stuff. And one of the big concerns that we have inside of those customers is the fact that they have no clustering expertise at all.
Yeah.
And so what we do to drive maximum performance for them is we'll run standalone Hyper-V servers because they don't really need to transition workloads all that often. It's just really in the event of an emergency. What we'll do is have a good backup solution like Veeam, so we're always protected. And then what we'll do is we'll take and we'll use local solid state drives to drive maximum I/O on the individual nodes. And then we'll connect either a bonded gig or 10 gig network in behind. So I have some really good solutions for you for those SMB customers that will not break your bank. Because the moment you have to introduce shared storage and you add these tiers and you're networking, it complicates the crap out of things. And for just having to look after four or five VMs, is it all worth it to actually go through and, you know, cluster all that?
Some of the deployment scenarios. So Microsoft has kind of really changed the way that they do their licensing. So Hyper-V server itself, regardless of which edition you have here, the Hyper-V server itself is free, right? But with it being free, you're not pre-licensed for any what they call OSE or operating system environment under Hyper-V free. So I need to make sure that I've got licensing for all those guest operating systems. If they're Windows-based, right? If they're Linux-based, there's separate licensing that goes along with that. But if you step up to standard, you can run two pre-licensed Windows guest VMs on there. And then if you go up to the data center edition, which is most enterprise environments run, they're able to deploy unlimited amount of Windows operating system environments on there in a pre-licensed format.
What about Windows 10 Pro, let's say?
Yeah, so I mean, the client operating system itself, if you were gonna run that in a VDI type scenario, I know the VDI licensing is completely.
No, but let's say I install Hyper-V on my Windows 10 machine, which I run now. And I think I have like 60 VMs in there.
Right.
Is there a limit to the number I can have? Or like you're saying two guests, like I have 60.
To that you're licensed for. The technical limit is not there from stopping you building VMs.
Sure.
It's what you're actually licensed for to actually run on top of there. So if you're doing it in a development or an MVP perspective, we would load our TechNet or MSDN licenses on there, because those are non-prod workloads.
Sure.
And so that's typically the licensing measure that those would be covered
so,
under.
So technically MSDN is like however I want to...
As long as it's non-prod, right?
And then also, there's also, if you go out and download off the interwebs, the TechNet, right? The TechNet Eval Center, you get 180-day free trials.
Sure.
And then even after the 180-day free trials, you can do the SLMGR rearm command that'll rearm it again for another 180 days, and you can do that up to 3 times. So you can get essentially a year's worth of free.
That actually raises a really valid point, though. One of the beautiful things about Hyper-V is the fact that you can actually run Hyper-V as a client on top of a client OS like Windows 8.1 or Windows 10. And so one of the really important takeaways for you guys is the fact that the core binaries of Hyper-V, regardless if it's Hyper-V Server,
right,
regardless if it's going to be running on Windows 10, if it's going to be running on Windows Server 2016, as long as you're in the same general family set from Microsoft, those Hyper-V binaries are exactly the same. Those don't change. It's not like you're getting a reduced version of Hyper-V. Now, if you're running on Windows 10 itself, obviously you can't do like failover clustering on a Windows 10 laptop, but the actual Hyper-V portion of that, it runs exactly
the
same.
And the VMs that you create, you can upload in Azure or anywhere.
Exactly.
It's the same.
Well, and that's one of the reasons that Microsoft made kind of what we'll call a universal Hyper-V binaries like that, so the experience for the developers and doing that stuff versus running in production, it's exactly the same. And they wanted to give a platform and a framework that anybody could use and learn and whatever, right? So if you're looking to just learn Hyper-V and do this stuff, you could fire up a Windows 10 laptop, you could run like on your Surface or something like that, you could load Hyper-V, you could build VMs on that.
Right.
And those VMs are portable.
On my laptop right here, this is a Windows 10 laptop that I have, I've got the Hyper-V role enabled, and I have quite a few different virtual machines that you can see here running.
And you could actually do shared nothing live migration into the data center with that. So from Clint's laptop, if he had like a data center running and he had some Hyper-V hosts in there, he could actually do shared nothing live migration from that laptop over into that farm.
Right. So I was just fixing the screen there.
Yep, no problem.
Whenever you're adding Hyper-V, so in order to run failover clustering, obviously the machines need to be a part of a domain. You can't add those, they can't be a member of a work group. And then all I've done here is just included some sample PowerShell commands that you would use to enable the Windows Hyper-V role, as well as the management tools, and also create a new virtual switch and install the failover clustering feature as well. So you can, it's really easy to do this stuff, right? It doesn't have to be complicated. Some networking considerations. Within Hyper-V world, they have 3 different types of switches. There's internal, external, and private. Right, internal would only allow virtual machines on that vSwitch to have access to each other. No external access.
Except for the host,
obviously.
Yep.
The external switch allows you to get out into the internet and things like that. And then a private switch is completely segregated off. It's isolated so that that's more secure.
For sure. Should we share something really cool with these guys that I just found out about a week ago about the Hyper-V networking?
It's related to networking.
So converged networking, this is a really big part of Windows Server 2012. So when you take and you're designing your data center, you want to have 10 gig or gig infrastructure. We can now use Windows teaming, native Windows teaming, starting with Windows 2012, 2012 R2, and 2016, which is great because I don't have a reliance on the network vendors teaming software to do the configurations. It's all supported with configurations via PowerShell. We've got the ability to take and quickly stand that up. And does it work? Yes, absolutely. It works really well. There are actually no speed limits when you take and you configure that Windows team. Now, the interesting part about this is once you layer the Hyper-V virtual switch, the extensible virtual switch, the native one that comes with Hyper-V, on top of either a physical adapter or a team, in Windows Server 2012 R2, something that I just learned last week based on a premier case that I was working on with a customer. As soon as we loaded that, our speed dropped. We actually took a big performance hit across those virtual adapters that were bound inside of that host. And so basically, if I took, and envision this for me, okay, I have two servers, and I have two 10 gig cards, one on either side, and I take and hook a crossover cable between both servers, okay? Can you guys visualize that for me? When I copy from server one to server two with no networking configured, just IP on the adapters, I get full 10 gig line speed, gigabit per second, super fast file copies basically, okay? Then I would install the Windows teaming on either side. So I would set up some teams and configure. I still got 10 gig connectivity, cool. Then the next step is you wanna add the Hyper-V virtual switch on top of that. The moment that I did that, my connectivity speeds went down to 300 megabit. And I'm thinking to myself, gotta be a bug, something's up, what is going on? 4 days later, troubleshooting with Premier support, still no answers. Couldn't figure out what was going on. I said, there's gotta be something throttling in here. There's something weird that's going on. Here's what happened, guys, is what I found out actually from Ben Armstrong and the product team at Microsoft for Hyper-V. In 2012 R2, there is a limitation on the virtual adapters that could get created inside of Hyper-V. It's a maximum of the sustainable throughput on one processor, which is typically between 3 to 5 megabits, so 30 to 50% of that 10 gig adapter. Now, what this means is that when you have two hosts wanting to talk to one another, host to host, you can only copy at a maximum of like 300 megs a second instead of full gigabit, 300 to 500 megs a second, so it's throttled. Good news is, Server 2016, they fixed this. That traffic can now copy at 56 gigabit. Okay, so that's good news for us. They fixed it, but in Server 2012 R2, they have it. So the moment that you do that, and here's where it becomes interesting. If you only had two 10 gig adapters in your host, which a lot of people do, and they set converged networking up inside their data center because they want to reduce their port count. They don't want all these cables coming out of the back of their servers. They only want two cables coming out the back. The moment that you do that and start converging your network adapters, so you run your iSCSI, you run your live migration, your cluster shared volume, all the networks that you typically build for a virtual environment, those are choked out. Okay, now VM to VM, vSwitch to vSwitch, so you had a Hyper-V host here, Hyper-V host here, you can do 20 gigabit switch to switch. It's only on the virtual adapters.
And access external things outside of that.
So you say
it's using one core, like if it's a multi-core, it's only using the speed of one core.
It's addressed, they know about it, and it's not actually published anywhere. You won't find that anywhere on TechNet. So that's your little gold nugget. So if you guys want maximum performance out of your Hyper-V host, because this is what I do, guys. I tweak, I tune, I speed test this stuff. I work for a vendor that sells an all-flash array, so we need maximum throughput because if you choke that out, it doesn't run very good, right? And so what we have to do is we have to go 4 10 gig adapters per host to get maximum throughput. Now for an SMB, for example, they'd never notice. They would never notice that. But if you're building a high-density VDI farm where you're trying to stack as many virtual machines in that infrastructure as possible, you're trying to get like 100 to 150 running VDI instances per host, you do not want any bottlenecks. So in that design, in 2012 R2, it requires me to have an extra 2 10 gig ports, and I have to dedicate those for the storage network, and then I have to take and I have to set those up and configure them so that they do not have a Hyper-V virtual switch on that network, just a Windows team. Okay, does that make sense? So I've been a Hyper-V MVP for 5 years. I just learned that last week. I was doing an install in Ireland. I was working shift work. So when I found that out, I wasn't a real happy camper because it meant that we had to go order some more cables for the other side, because I have done it a lot where we would take and do that because I want to reduce the port count too. The good news is that the top of rack switches, the ones that sit, the 10 gig switches, you can buy a 48 port top of rack switch now for like $10,000. They're not as expensive as they used to be for the 10 gig infrastructure. So is it really the end of the world right now for most installs? No. If you're building that kind of infrastructure, adding a couple extra switches in there is probably not going to break your bank for the project, but you have to make sure you design that properly.
Yeah.
okay? Otherwise, you're going to seriously have a big choke point. Okay, so that's your gold nugget for MVP days.
So Microsoft, in just general best practice, right, recommends with current networking designs and core in networking cards that are out there is using 10 gig interfaces for all these types of traffic, right? As Dave mentioned, having, you know, iSCSI, live migration, domain traffic, all going over the same set of teamed interfaces potentially, right? And segmenting those out, you know, just using different VLANs, or if you're even if your environment or your switch switching infrastructure supports like LACP or virtual port channeling, you can bond those together to get maximum performance. Some of the even more modern network adapters support RDMA or remote direct memory access. So what that'll actually allow, and that'll offload a lot of the CPU cycles that it takes to take those inbound and out, inbound network packets that are coming in. It'll offload the processing of those and the allocation of each individual VM down to the network card itself. Kind of the call out with using RDMA NICs is that they can't be a part of a Windows team. They're just single adapters, okay? So they can't be a part of a physical network team. And then also it's best practice whenever you're using native Windows Server and Hyper-V to use the Microsoft NIC teaming that's built into Server 2012 R2.
And I wish some of my customers I'm working with now had watched our session, because I just ran across one this past week. I was actually doing a support call on Monday. I checked the teaming drivers that they had. They're like, oh, no, we just used the native Intel teaming drivers. I'm like, oh, why did you do that?
Right.
Nobody does that anymore. That was the old way of doing it in 2008. Well, that's the way we knew how. Crap.
Whenever you add 10 gig NICs to a team, and I'll actually go out and it'll enable VMQ by default. With 1 gig NICs, you do not want to enable 1 gig, or excuse me, with 1 gig NICs, you do not want to enable VMQ, because a lot of the 1 gig NICs, they have bugs in their drivers, and it'll actually cause your Hyper-V host to blue screen in some specific situation. So whenever we move forward to storage, this is probably the largest bottleneck in any enterprise or even small business environment, because one of the greatest parts about virtualization is how fast that you can stand up workloads, deploy things, and oftentimes storage just kind of gets left to the wayside. It's never really a true consideration until it's a problem or there's a bottleneck. So as we were kind of talking earlier, whenever you're presenting, you know, LUNs, volumes, iSCSI targets to a Hyper-V host as part of a cluster, it uses and stores all those using, I totally forgot the...
Cluster shared volumes.
No.
Mount points.
Mount points, yeah. Sorry, my brain stopped
for a
second.
I'm a telepath.
So if I go to C cluster storage on any of my Hyper-V nodes that are part of that cluster and have access to the disk, I'll see all the different cluster shared volumes underneath there.
What are you supposed to say?
So now we're going to talk about...
he was supposed to say Dave is awesome.
VHDX.
My abilities are sleeping.
Server 2012 R2 introduced the new file format, VHDX, as opposed to the traditional VHD. VHDX is actually improves a lot of the capabilities and performance impacts whenever it comes to virtual hard disks. So you definitely want to get on the latest and greatest edition of Windows Server.
One last thing for storage considerations. One of the things that a lot of people don't know about is that on your cluster shared volumes, when you configure those in the failover cluster, you can actually enable something called a CSV cache, which is specifically designed for VDI instances that are actually running inside of your failover clusters in Hyper-V. Yeah. So there is a CSV cache for kind of a turbo or speed boost.
Then there's also, whenever you're creating virtual hard disks within Hyper-V, there's the option to create a fixed disk, which is a thick provisioned hard drive. There's also dynamically expanding, which is thin provision, meaning if I present this virtual hard disk to 10 gigabytes and it's only using 400 meg, right, it's only going to use the 400 meg and it's going to dynamically expand as that grows. But then there's also differencing hard drives as well, which whenever they're non-persistent disks, so if you ever go to attach those to a VM reboot, the changes are lost, right? It's non-persistent. It's great for VDI installations.
Can I add one more thing inside of here? Is that okay?
Yeah, absolutely, Dave.
So have you guys ever worked in Hyper-V and seen your VMs go pause critical? Has anybody ever seen that on your Hyper-V hosts, specifically if you run a volume out of disk space? So it's a really bad idea in Hyper-V to run your volumes at a disk space. And the reason is that included inside of...
You think it's a bad idea?
Well, there's a reason.
There might be a problem.
Yeah, well, first of all, it's got zero blocks left that it can actually write data, so you can't grow anymore. So that's a problem, right? So the second problem that you run into is that in the Hyper-V VM working folder, if you actually dig in inside of that working folder when you create a VM, there's a GUID, and it looks like there's an XML file in there, and underneath there is what's called a .bin file. The .bin file is where your active memory state is. So when you set 4 gigs of RAM on a virtual machine, it creates a 4 gig of RAM bin file. That's the page file for the Hyper-V virtual machine. And it needs that space in order to start the VM. So guess what happens when you fill your volumes and you go to hit start on all of your VMs? None of them will actually turn on because it can't actually build the .bin file. So it'll start one until it actually fills up the volume. And then the rest of them, they'll all fail starting because there's no disk space actively left for them. So when you take and you build and you design and architect your Hyper-V solutions, let's say you have a host with 256 gigs of RAM, and you're going to put 256 gigs of RAM worth of VMs on a particular volume for whatever reason, make sure you leave at least 256 gigs of disk space left for the bin files. Okay? And you want to actively monitor your disk space as part of your maintenance plan. It's no different than what you're going to do in VMware,
right.
But that's something where your disk space will just disappear. Just go turn on all your VMs. You just watch in Windows Explorer, your disk space just goes gone. What happened? What's chewing up all my disk space? Well, that's what's actually chewing up all your disk space.
So what do you think this looks like in a real life scenario? So here you can see at the top we've got all of our virtual machines running on our Hyper-V node. But then as we drill down into it, right, I can see within here I've either got my 1 gig or 10 gig physical NICs that are going to be a part of a team. If I want to aggregate those together, right, I can do that as well. I'm just calling out down here, talking about the VMQ on 10 gig being enabled by default as opposed to the 1 gig interfaces. And then on the bottom right-hand side down here, whenever you're using RDMA or RDMA-supported network adapters, NIC teaming is not supported. So as I fast-forward this here and move to kind of what it looks like a little bit further, just showing you here that, you know, yes, I can have a NIC team with physical network adapters. They're a part of it. But then in the red blocks here, right, I can see that I have RDMA-enabled NICs that aren't part of a network team. In this graphic here actually came courtesy of Aiden Finn, who's another Microsoft MVP. I got this off of his blog site, so just giving credit where credit is due to the folks in the community.
Question for you.
Yes, sir.
With Hyper-V, you assign your NICs to it. It's going to be using for its traffic. You assign it, like you bind the two together. You put in LACP. But I'm just pulling this from the ESX side, where ESX you can choose the type of failover or the method that it manages the LACP. Does Hyper-V have that option as well?
Yes, you can do IP hash. What are the other
Hyper-V port, or you can do dynamic.
Okay.
And so basically, when you configure with LACP, for example. That's going to let the switch do all the work. The switch is going to make those decisions with LACP. If you want Hyper-V to make those decisions and you're trying to be a little more transparent to your switch stack, you'll use switch independent teaming, and you'll leave the mode to dynamic. Address hash is kind of the normal way that it'll load balance traffic. Hyper-V port looks at the actual Hyper-V switch for a distribution method, and dynamic is kind of a combination of both. The recommendation in Server 2012 R2 is to always leave that mode to dynamic, which it defaults to. And so really, switch independent versus LACP. Do I want Hyper-V to make the decisions on load balancing, or LACP, do I want the switch, the actual physical switch, to make the decisions from a load balancing perspective?
Right. So different ways that you can manage VMs, right? There's Hyper-V, failover cluster manager. There's Hyper-V manager as well. If you've ever managed a Windows Server failover cluster, there's a lot of complexity that comes along with that, right? So that can oftentimes make things a little bit more complicated than it needs to be or you want it to be. And it could potentially kind of get ugly quick if you're not necessarily the most seasoned IT guy out there in that space. Other ways that Microsoft addresses the management aspects is with Virtual Machine Manager. Personally, I'm not necessarily the greatest fan of VMM. I think that this even adds more complexity.
He's being really polite. I hate it.
than it's tough.
Wait,
right?
Crap, we're recording that.
There's a lot of challenges, right? Not only in massive scale environments, the limitations, right? Being able to only manage up to 25,000 VMs, but then also there's third-party management tools that are available, even in free versions, right? So our friends over at Five9 Software create third-party management tools completely free. They have paid versions and free versions, but the free version works really well to kind of test it out and see how it works. But basically puts a user interface and it removes a lot of the complexity that VMM provides.
Failover cluster support inside
Failover
of Five9.
Cluster, and even in the latest version that they're going to have coming
support,
out, they're going to have support for Nano Server too. So probably some of the things that often get overlooked are the most obvious, right? So making sure that my servers are patched, my host servers, my guest VMs are patched, making sure that my hardware, this is probably a piece that doesn't get any attention whatsoever, would be the hardware. Updating BIOSes, making sure that my network cards are running the latest and greatest firmware. Because I've personally been burned by that in my previous life. Whenever I was the VMware admin, my storage guys, we used to run on IBM SVC, and one weekend they decided to do a code upgrade, and the actual fiber channel adapters we had in the servers weren't compatible with the level of firmware that they went to, and that created a 280 blade problem for us in our environment that we had to go and fight a massive fire on. So checking hardware compatibility lists. And I know this sounds, and I'm probably you guys know this stuff, but like in the heat of the moment, we all have good intentions, but the obvious things are what get overlooked, right? So some of the things that Microsoft's doing in regards to ensuring that like integration services is equivalent to what VMware Tools is in the Hyper-V world, right? Integration services in Hyper-V 2016 are gonna be downloaded and retrieved via the standard Windows update process.
So right? as long as you have your VMs enabled for Windows update, either through a WSUS infrastructure, SCCM, whatever it is, if inside of there's an update to the virtual machine and the integration sets, the tools, they'll automatically update themselves. Because today they don't. Because when you update a host,
right,
the version of integrated services is going to change, and then you have to manually or scriptomatically go through and update those.
And that's been a huge problem. Even, you know, coming from the VMware side, right, having tools out of date and having to script all that, it's not, or using VMware Update Manager to go out and automate that. Microsoft's traditionally you had to mount an ISO file that was retrieved off the Hyper-V host, and you update them that way, or as Dave said, scriptomagically get the job done.
I call it integration services drift.
Right.
So lots of people have written like PowerShell reports that give you HTML output that'll actually show that stuff. Because remember, those integration services included in the different versions that come down that are available for your Windows Server 2012, that could have been like fixing critical flaws. That could have been fixing blue screen issues. That could have been fixing network performance issues. That could have been fixing a myriad of things.
Updated drivers.
Right? So Microsoft's obviously seen that something needs to be updated on there, but those Hyper-V guests, they need to be updated with those too, and that's not automatic.
So we've talked a lot about protecting and ensuring high availability on local workstations, right? But what if I actually wanted to try to back this stuff up? And that's really where the company that I work for, being Veeam Software, comes into play here. So as we deploy applications and operating systems, Microsoft has a suite of products, System Center, right? They've got Virtual Machine Manager, Operations Manager, a whole list. Config Manager is probably the most commonly deployed component of the System Center suite. But being able to manage those workloads that you're running here. But the problem is the fact that I'm virtualizing things. That's a huge issue, because the underlying management layer, right, if I was trying to manage things through Ops Manager and get alerts and alarms and things like that, it's not necessarily aware of what a VM is, what shared storage, what a data store is, what storage latency, you know, CPU co-stop, all those VMware native or Hyper-V native performance metrics, has no idea. So what we can do is we can pull a lot of that information into System Center, but also we have the flagship product, which is Veeam Backup and Replication. This is probably what we're most notably known for in the industry, being able to back up and protect VMware and Hyper-V workloads, whether they're on-prem or even off-prem, and trying to push them out to, say, for instance, Azure for backup, disaster recovery, business continuity. Anyone in the room ever heard of the 3-2-1 rule by chance? 3-2-1? Three copies of my data, two different types of media, one offsite. Unfortunately, the part of that that folks really struggle with is the offsite piece. It's really tough. It really, really, really can be tough. Whenever I was kind of on that side of the fence for our mission critical apps, we had a co-location data center that we used, but then we also used tape for a lot of the other stuff that we needed to get offsite. And tape introduces even more complexity than any one of us care to deal with.
Can I just relate a real life story to people if you don't follow that 3-2-1 rule? And this is regardless of you, if you work with Veeam, this should just be for your availability and backup strategy. Most people are going nearline for their backups today in some way, shape, or form. For all intents and purposes, tapes are dead. Most people are going to disk for their backups. They have a NAS or some type of a device that they're backing up to. They'll just go buy a giant NAS, pop like 4 terabyte drives in it, and it's just a giant dumping ground for all their backups. Ooh, look at us. We have 48 terabytes of space that we can dump all of our backups. What they forget to realize is that their file server backups, their Exchange backups, everything now live on that array. What happens when that array goes poof? No backups. Your VMs are still running, but no backups. And the CEO comes to you and says, Sally got let go 6 months ago, and there's some type of illegal litigation, and I need that file from 6 months ago. Yeah, boss, about that. Yeah, not good. So that last piece in the 3-2-1, having that off-site, is so critical because you can't trust that array that you have is going to survive. And I have actually killed arrays like that. So I've used like QNAP arrays and stuff like that to dump the backups to. What you have to understand is you're pushing those arrays really hard, dumping, and they're ingesting a lot of data. And so when the backup cycles run for your farm, you're actually hitting those arrays really hard, like almost to like maximum performance in the evening for like 3 hours while you're doing your backups, and then nothing. And then 3 hours, and then nothing. Those are spinning disks.
Or even longer, right?
Those
maybe
are
8 hours, depending on how much data you're trying to do. Is it
those
full backup?
Spinning disks, and then they're thrashing.
Then
they're thrashing, and I find the longevity of those backup appliances, the disks in there, isn't great. Like, you're getting, like, depending on what type of drives you have in there, you're getting, like, 1 to 2 years out of those drives. So all of a sudden, that array goes poof.
So we actually recommend is kind of our reference architecture for backup. The ultimate VM backup solution would be like a Cisco 3160 or a 3260 or a JBOD or an Apollo, HP Apollo 4200, just a bunch of disks. Back things up locally, only keep, say, 14, 28 days on-prem, and then use other methodologies that we have things built into our product to help achieve this, but get the rest of the data off-site, off-prem, whether that be to a dedupe storage appliance that's like a data domain or an HP store once or Quantum, or even the cloud or a managed service, get it out of the data center, because now I've got out of band, completely separate geolocated data in the center. If this have a smoking crater situation over here where my data center goes down, I'm protected, right? So the problems that we're seeing in the modern data center today is with folks, the increasing amount of data, but also the kind of the becoming of this always-on enterprise kind of mentality where folks want access to their data 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and having zero to little tolerance for any type of unnecessary system downtime. So IT pros and CIOs and IT organizations around the world are trying to fix these issues by using virtualization, by using modern storage, by using cloud. And what really, where Veeam plugs into that is being able to enable all the features, high-speed recovery, how fast can I get my data back, how fast can I back it up. So, Veeam,
you have a question.
Yes, sir.
I know a lot of issues that we have isn't the off-site backup, is what you do and how long you keep them off-site, because there's only so much space you want to rent or buy, right? But then after that, what do you do with the drives? Like, can you reuse them, or we're struggling with what to do with all that data.
Yeah,
usually
it's a good question.
So
Normally, organizations, what they'll do is they'll create basically policy-driven jobs so that they'll ship monthlies, and they'll keep 12 copies of monthlies. And then after they have their 12 copies of monthlies, how many of those do you want to keep? Then we convert those over to yearlies, and how many of those yearlies do we want to keep? So then it reduces the amount of storage on those sets, and then what they'll do is they'll just wrap each other. So you're not just burning unnecessary
space. It's called grandfather, father, son retention policy. So like, on-prem, I would keep 14, 28 days, 30 days, whatever, locally. But then having jobs as the data gets shipped off-site, right? I only want to keep four, let's say I want to keep 12 monthlies, four yearlies, and, I don't know, maybe four quarterlies, right? So as the data expires, it gets wiped, deleted.
And do you convert them over to, like, because I guess, like, 20 years ago, we were all using tape, right?
Right.
But now you can fit, like, a terabyte drive in your pocket almost now. So would you convert that over to the new format, or do you just leave it as tape if you need to save it?
They're raw files, and they can actually be explored. So I'm talking from Veeam's perspective.
Yeah.
If you have the Veeam console installed on a machine, and you grab one of the backup files, if it's not encrypted with a password or something like that, you can just double-click on it. You can go through the Explorer. You can browse the backup sets, and you can just restore it anyway.
Files, right?
It's just a bunch of
from
files.
From our perspective,
it's not like a proprietary format that can't be browsed. You'd still need the Veeam Explorer to do it.
It's proprietary to anybody that doesn't have Veeam.
Exactly.
Because it's they're Veeam-based backup files, right? But to Dave's point, right, you don't even need to have Veeam installed anywhere. There's a command line utility that you can use to restore things. So if I say, for instance, I did have stuff on tape that I wanted to get on disk, you'd pop the tape in the library, attach that, be able to browse the tape, get the actual files, and then just move those off to a disk-based location, just using, you know, robocopy scripts, for instance.
That would make it easier instead of having, like, 20 tapes. You now have one hard drive.
Yes.
Right. And then you don't have to worry about, I mean, there's a lot of, I mean, proper handling of tapes is a huge thing, too, making sure that you've got the right tape libraries. But yeah. So, in the interest of time, kind of wrapping things up for you guys here, we have a lot of different free tools, but if you take away anything from today, is this one over here on the right-hand side. It's called Veeam Endpoint Backup. So if I have any physical servers in my data center, it's completely free. You can use this to back up to a Veeam repository, manage it, backs up server 2012, 2012 R2, fully supported. But also, if you have your Windows-based laptops, I have this installed on my mom's PC at home. It backs up. I use it on all my stuff. I can create bare metal media, so I can actually do bare metal recovery of, say, for instance, my Surface or my laptop. And it's all VSS integrated, so I'm taking VSS snapshots so I can restore individual items completely 100% free.
I've used it.
It's pretty slick.
The CIO blows up their laptop and you need to restore it back. You just go buy some metal and just lay it back down.
It's funny because you can actually use Veeam Endpoint Backup. Free utility. Free tool. If you have something running in Azure, I can use Veeam Endpoint Backup, back it up in Azure using Veeam Endpoint Backup, and restore it on-prem on a physical machine, but I've restored it as a Hyper-V Generation 1 virtual machine from Azure. So I installed something in Azure, backed it up, restored it on-prem using a free Veeam tool.
I've used it for, I was working IT for a small company. We got bought out. When we got bought out, they had their own IT team, but before they took over, my instinct told me to take a backup of all my services just in case. I did exactly that, and sure enough, 6 months later, they needed access to a server that they'd already killed our primary controller, so they no longer had access to that server. It was a SAM server, and I'm like, hey guys, I happen to have a read-only AD that we can pull up in
nice.
VMs and use that exact tool that did exactly.
Yeah,
it's super beautiful. Easy to set up and install too, guys. Like,
yeah,
this is basically like a next finish target those machines.
We're
going to
be
good to go.
Very, very, very soon. We're going to be launching the Linux version of Veeam Endpoint Backup.
Nice.
So I'll be able to back up physical Linux-based workloads if I've got stuff running out in, say, for instance, AWS. One of the most commonly deployed workloads in the Amazon cloud today is Linux-based workloads.
Supporting
OS X? No OS X. Yeah, only Windows-based at this point.
Veeam really focuses on mainstream storage arrays, mainstream OSs, mainstream hypervisors, and the reason for that is you've got to look at the development efforts and initiatives and
payback. No, I understand
that.
It's just one of those. I'm just curious.
Yeah.
Well, guys, we thank you very much for your time. That's all that Dave and I had planned. So if you have any questions or anything, we'll be around for the rest of the day. Feel free to hit us up on Twitter